Welcome to Church Life Today, a production of the Graff Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame. I'm your host, Leonard DiLorenzo. On today's program, we talk with Dr. Susan Reynolds, Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University. An experienced teacher and parish minister, Dr. Reynolds is now closely following transformations in the U.S. Catholic Church in terms of ethnic makeup, geographic shifts, and migration. A graduate of the University of Notre Dame, as well as Boston College, Dr. Reynolds makes space in the halls of higher education for pressing issues in the life of the church. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lenny.
So you used to be a middle school teacher in the border town of Brownsville, Texas, at a Catholic school, and your place of work now is a major research university, Emory, where you teach and research in Catholic studies. And yet I've noticed that the border hasn't left you. How are borderlands central to your work as a Catholic theologian?
That's a great question, Lenny. So the work that I do revolves around racially and culturally and linguistically diverse Catholic parishes. And this was an interest that began for me when I lived in Brownsville. I taught in a school that was about one-third white Euro-American, probably a little more than a third Latino, and about a third Filipino. So it was this very fascinating tricultural, in some way trilingual school. I was the director of the children's choir there, actually. And at various points, all three of those cultural traditions were incorporated into the liturgies that we would do every Friday as a school. And I became deeply fascinated with how, in some way, there was a borderland quality, not only to the place that I lived, the broader place, but also the place that I taught and worshiped. This parish was, in some way, like a borderland. It was a place where multiple cultures and languages and generations and histories met and negotiated with one another. When I moved to Boston for graduate school in theology, both my master's and my PhD, the first year that I was there, I lived in the rectory of a parish, mostly because I had no money, because I had a Catholic middle school teacher right. in the valley. And this was a good opportunity to have a place to live. And it was Boston. And so a number of rectories were without a priest in residence right. because of the priest shortage there. And so I lived in a rectory in a sort of an urban, very under-resourced Catholic parish in the neighborhood of Roxbury. And this parish, too, was in some way a borderland, not unlike the parish that I had left in Brownsville. The English-speaking community was both African-American, Afro-Caribbean, and white. And then there was a very large and growing, very dynamic Latino population as well, mostly Dominican and Puerto Rican. And it was fascinating to me to watch the sort of interactions and negotiations and friendships and relationships and tensions sort of develop among parishioners. And I had this very fascinating view on that from the inside out.
Yeah.
And so that, in a sense, this metaphor, I guess you could say, of the borderland became sort of the optic through which I began to study multicultural and multiracial parishes.
Very interesting. Now, I've heard you say at some point that in a lot of cases, like a multicultural parish is something of a misnomer. Like we use it perhaps too broadly. What do you mean by that when you've said that?
That's exactly right. I often use that terminology just because it's what most people recognize.
Right,
but
right.
Terming most parishes multicultural is an overstatement.
Uh-huh.
When we think of multiculturalism, what we think of is at least some sort of interaction or integration across boundary lines. In reality, most multicultural, quote-unquote multicultural parishes are really what scholars and actually in the USCCB term shared parishes.
Uh-huh.
Essentially, one, two, you know, three, four multiple cultural, ethnic, or linguistic communities essentially sharing space, but not much else, right? They sort of orbit around one another. We attend different masses. We participate in different ministries. We, you know, have different social circles. And in most cases, there are very few, if any, authentic relationships, you know, between those multiple cultural communities.
Right. So like a sort of like coincident separation, like separate circles that happen to be coexisting in the same place, but nothing that we would, or maybe nothing is a little too strong, but not the full sense of what we would want to call communion and a single community in that case.
That's precisely right. And that's a question that is really an urgent one for me. And I think in some way for anyone who attends or belongs to or ministers in one of these kinds of parishes, which are, as we know, about one third of Catholic parishes and rising today, are a shared parish or a so-called multicultural parish. And in parishes like these, right, in a sense, the most urgent question is, what do we mean by community? Mm. Can we call this place a community in any meaningful sense? Sometimes you hear the language of a shared parish being a community of communities,
okay,
almost like a mini diocese unto itself, which is a fascinating model. And in a sense, I think it's an accurate one for describing what that kind of space is. But that still kind of begs the question, what do we mean by community in a larger sense? And what do we even really mean when we talk about parish life anymore, when you really just have these sort of separate spheres orbiting around each other, coexisting in this common space, but really sharing very little in the way of community life?
Well, where do you see in the parish the possibilities of actually forming or building communion across these sort of what I imagine are many times invisible lines of separation?
Yeah, that's a great question. The space that I'm most interested in my own work is the space of ritual and liturgical participation.
Hmm.
Now, of course, as anyone listening who has ever attended a bilingual Mass can certainly tell you, right, going to Mass together and, you know, going to sharing in a bilingual Mass does not make us a community. In
right.
fact, usually people leave frustrated and a little angry. Often it's very stilted or, you know, it's far from seamless, even in parishes that do this consistently. The parish that I went to, that I belonged to in Boston, had bilingual Masses all the time. And in fact, many parishes in Brownsville have bilingual Masses pretty constantly because many people there are bilingual. And even in those places, it's far from a seamless process. And yet the liturgy does also offer us resources for coming together as a community, for sort of living in to the community that we hope to become.
Hmm. What is it that we do in liturgy, you think, that helps us to practice what we are not yet but want to become, as you're saying?
In my work, I draw on particularly U.S. Latino scholars, who scholars like Roberto Goizueta, who draw on this notion of liturgy as subjunctive activity. That term might be confusing to those of us who are native English speakers. There's a subjunctive tense in English, but we don't often learn it as such. But those who have studied foreign languages might be familiar with the subjunctive tense. When we speak in the subjunctive, we're speaking in an as-if tense. So
mm-hmm.
we're talking about what we wish would happen, what we hope were the case, so to speak. And so when scholars refer to liturgy as subjunctive action, what they're saying is through liturgical participation, embodied participation, liturgy offers us, in a sense, sort of an embodied script for acting like the kind of community that we hope to one day become, right? When we share peace with each other, when we, you know, share in the bread and wine together, when we sing together, even if we do so awkwardly or haltingly, in some way, we're invited. It doesn't happen automatically. It's not magic, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we're invited to sort of live into this community that we hope to someday become. We're invited to live into this body of Christ that we receive.
Very good. You're listening to Church Life Today on Redeemer Radio. We're talking with Dr. Susan Reynolds, Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University. Now, in terms of kind of practicing or seeing what we hope to become, but maybe are not yet and are in the process of becoming, I've been caught by what I've heard you name Pope Francis as a pastor of the
mm-hmm.
borders, as someone mm-hmm. who calls us to make the peripheries the centers of our liturgical imagination, of our pastoral attention. How have you seen him embody this or communicate this or urge this shift in the center?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so for Pope Francis, I really see this sort of commitment to the peripheries, to the borderlands in our midst is almost a thesis statement of his pontificate. And we see this time and time again in his liturgical practice. We saw this in Lampedusa, for example, and we saw it again when he visited the U.S.-Mexico border from the Mexico side, from Juarez in 2016. While he was there during his papal visit to Mexico, he paused for prayer at a memorial that was constructed in memory of the thousands of migrants who've lost their lives trying to reach the United States. And this memorial was constructed on this platform that directly overlooked the international crossing between Juarez and El Paso, which is this sort of, it's a fascinating space because it's both very, very militarized, and it's also very transnational. Actually, it's one of the most frequently crossed borders, points of any border, I think, in the world. Actually, right. I think about 14,000 people cross that border every single day, quote unquote, legally for, you know, to visit family or go to school or whatever. Right. But so it's this really kind of a fascinating space. And this memorial was constructed out of iron, and it really sort of evoked this iron bars of the border fence in many places. And he just paused in this space for about 2 or 3 minutes. He was in silent prayer. In some way, it was this kind of subversive witness, this call for all of us in a way to dwell in the borders, to dwell in the in-between spaces, to not run from them, but rather to run toward them, right, in hopes for communion with our near and distant neighbors. After he was there, he moved to celebrate Mass in Juarez, which was simulcast across the border to a crowd that was gathered in the Sun Bowl in El Paso, and a lot more people, many more gathered along both sides of the border fence on either side of the Rio Grande to sort of participate in solidarity. And when it came time for the Eucharist, communion was distributed on both sides of the border simultaneously, both in the stadiums and also to the people that were gathered along the fence. And the images from that day were, they give me pause whenever I look at photos of communion being distributed along the border, because it really, in a sense, it's an act of liturgical truth-telling, in a sense. It's sort of a statement of the unity of the body of Christ that refuses to be divided by these imposed borders and by the more insidious borders of fear and suspicion that many of us hold in our hearts.
Liturgical truth-telling is such a powerful phrase, and the image that you're kind of painting for us of what actually happened. So there's one altar and one sacrifice of the Mass in one place, I'm taking it, and the distribution, the sharing of the body of Christ went across the two borders. Is that right?
Precisely.
Wow.
Precisely.
And the previous image that you're calling our attention to of him, the Pope, staying, just pausing and remaining in a space that's in between, and you drawing our attention to that to say that's, you think that's it's an intentional move. It's a prophetic move to say, don't run from one place to another. Don't scurry away from the place that's difficult. Actually remain in the place in between. This is where communion and prayer is at home.
That's exactly right. And it's so relevant to our own practice in our parishes, right? Because many people, I hear all the time, because of the work that I do, from people in parishes all over the country who are, you know, struggling, as we all are, to try and build a community, deep, authentic community in shared multicultural parishes. And they've tried this and they've tried that, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's been awkward. It's been uncomfortable. They say, well, the Spanish speakers don't want to participate, or they say, well, we feel marginalized or whatever. You know, there's all these tensions there. And the easiest thing to do is just to kind of give up, right? It's so much easier just to exist in our own spaces. And I should say, too, that those culturally specific spaces in parishes are very important. Right. The goal isn't just to make every Mass a bilingual Mass and to make everybody else, to make everybody feel a little bit culturally homeless all the time. Right. No one wants that. And we know you know, for immigrant communities in particular, but also, you know, subsequent generation communities, having spaces of sort of religio-cultural empowerment and memory is vitally important and has been really for the past several hundred years of Catholicism in the United States.
Right.
So that's those culturally specific spaces are not bad, right? So we're not saying the coexistence of these spheres, so to speak, is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is bad, right, is when those differences calcify into divisions, these sort of unbreachable hidden walls in our parish that it's just so much easier to run away from than to ever dare cross.
Ooh, wonderfully said. You're listening to Church Life Today on Redeemer Radio. Again, we're talking with Dr. Susan Reynolds, Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University. So these borderlands are out there invisible, and we see them, and they're much on the news, and much at home in your work. They're right in our parishes, too. And mm-hmm. pointing to the work of the liturgy, the practice of ritual, the beauty of sacramental life as the possibility of not doing away with culturally specific spaces, but actually forging communion among difference. And
that's exactly right.
Something else that's caught my attention in what you've written about and talked about is in terms of the evangelization in the U.S. church that Latino Catholics are spearheading or really bringing forward. And you're also very careful to point out there's no such thing as one Latino experience. It's not a monolith. But
exactly.
All the same, broadly speaking, I was wondering if you could share with us some of the things you've seen, some of these ways in which this leadership and evangelization is emerging among the Latino community.
Sure, absolutely. And it's important to foreground this conversation by noting, as perhaps many of our listeners have heard, is this is a thing that started to get quite a lot of press, which is a good thing. But the recognition that today in the Catholic Church in the United States, about 40% of Catholics are Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And for those under around age 40, so like old millennials and younger, more than 50% of Catholics
right.
are Latino. And that means that for those who are Catholic school teachers, who are youth ministers, who work with children, the majority of Catholic children in the United States today are Latino. So the so-called face of the church in the U.S. is really changing in a very profound way. I think for a long time we looked at the Latino population in the U.S. Catholic Church and thought, okay, we need to evangelize them. We need to catechize them. It's sort of this one-way process. What I'm heartened to see scholars and pastoral theologians and parish workers and other people beginning to recognize is that in some ways, and in fact very profound ways, it's Latino Catholics who are, in a sense, evangelizing the U.S. church, revitalizing the United States church, or the church in the United States. And I can think of at least three ways in which that's the case. The first is sort of this intergenerational approach to ministry. Among sort of U.S. Hispanic, U.S. Latino models of ministry, what we find is that there's a much more sort of organic sense of intergenerationality. It's interesting, difficult, but also interesting, trying to have conversations that are sort of multicultural in nature about something like youth ministry,
mm-hmm.
Because for U.S. Latino communities, what we call youth and young adult ministry is actually this very broad, comprehensive ministry that encompasses people from like young teenagers all the way until 30-something. And in fact, for those of your listeners who have been to World Youth Day,
right.
they likely have been struck by how young the U.S. groups look.
Yes.
And that's because they are. The groups from Europe, the groups from Latin America and elsewhere, all are a lot older. They send groups who are like 20-something. That's because even the word youth in Spanish, and I think also in French and other places too, sort of translates to a slightly older demographic.
Right.
So that's sort of an interesting aside. But in any case, and of course, when families are, have different immigration experiences, when you have a first generation group of parents with a second generation group of children, for example. There's a lot of difference and a lot of tension there. So this is certainly, I'm not saying that there's some sort of ideal model here, but in general, ministry models of ministry in Hispanic ministry are much more sort of organically intergenerational than you find, among typical kind of U.S. models of ministry, which are very compartmentalized, right? We have our children's ministry, young adult ministry, middle school ministry, high school ministry, this, that, that. And they're all kind of in their separate spheres. And maybe there's like a parents' night, you know, but even then, I think, I was in youth group for 4 years in high school and my mom knew what we were doing like never. It was very, very siloed. And so I think one thing that U.S. Latinos call out of the church broadly in the United States is to think about ways we can be more organic, more intergenerational in our ministry.
Which seems like it has a lot more possibility for it seems like it has a lot more possibility there for like sustained accompaniment. If you're not graduating from youth so early and you're still being recognized as a young person for a longer period of time with, some older young people who are guiding the way, it does just strike me that there's more potential for accompaniment.
Oh, absolutely. And sort of these mentorship networks, right? Of course, we always talk about mentorship or leadership formation in the church, and it's hard to kind of impose something from the outside. But if these relationships are developing organically through models of ministry, then there's really a lot of potential there.
Very good. Now, that's one way in which the Latino community is offering leadership, Latino Catholics, in terms of broadening the sense of what young youth is. Is there another way or another couple ways that you mentioned?
Yeah, and another way I'll mention is very, very broadly speaking, sort of U.S. Latino theological aesthetics, I guess you could say. There's a real recognition within U.S. Latino theology, among U.S. Latino Catholics, broadly speaking, of what we might call the evangelizing capacity of beauty, right? And the Guadalupan tradition is a really beautiful sort of emblem of that. For those who are familiar with the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, right? It's the story, behind Juan Diego, behind Guadalupe, is this aesthetically charged, really beautiful, really fascinating story of this apparition, and this empowerment to this indigenous man, and a reversal of typical power relations. And that's a fascinating and beautiful story. But just as fascinating and beautiful is the image. Guadalupe herself. And there's a reason that, in Latino communities, both in Latin America and in the United States, you see her image everywhere, right? On the side of buildings and in the back of cars, and tattooed on arms. She's a stunning, stunning image. I think we see this in the sort of the aesthetic tradition in U.S. Latino theology more broadly, right? If you've ever been in a church in a Latino community, often the images of the saints, of Jesus, of the crucifix, there are very, very graphic, right? There's an aesthetic charge participating in the way of the cross, for example, in the parish in Boston where I lived, which was primarily led by the Latino community, was this, very, very powerful, very sensory experience through the streets of the neighborhood, not just within the church. So it was this public witness of beauty, in a sense, and it was very subversive. So I think particularly in a U.S. frame, as we, I think one of the challenges is particularly in youth ministry, often there's a desire to sort of draw on the emotions students, of young people.
That's a very gentle way of putting it.
We'll say that. Draw out the emotional experience of the faith. But there's not sort of a concomitant, robust commitment to, like, any deep theological aesthetics. So thinking about ways that we can incorporate experiences of theologically robust and authentic beauty, I think is another lesson that the U.S. Church broadly can learn from its 40% of Latino Catholics. And the other thing that I'll say, too, is Catholics should really have their eyes and their ears open because this fall, the fifth Encuentro is going to be held. Mm-hmm. And this is a massive gathering of Latino Catholics from all over the United States, essentially, forming networks, naming their experience, evangelizing one another, sharing the faith, and articulating priorities for Hispanic ministry going into the future. This is the fifth time it's been held, and out of each one of these have come very specific recommendations for what Latinos need in the United States from the United States Church and what they can contribute, which is very, very important. And regional gatherings have been held throughout the year, actually in areas all over the United States. This has been a highly participatory process and one that in some ways serves as a model for the entire church. But it's Catholics should really, really have their eyes open on this gathering because this is going to be, in a sense, again, the 40% of Latino Catholics in the United States naming their experience, naming their needs, naming their priorities.
I'm so glad that you said this is something of a model, because I was going to make the same comment there at the end as you were talking about, mm-hmm. that a way of reflection, a way of listening, a way of sharing experience, but also looking forward in hope and naming where we hope to go and mm-hmm. beginning the practices that will bring us into the reality we hope to see, as you were saying much earlier on about liturgical practice. Well, there's certainly a lot more that we could talk about, and maybe I'll just put you on the spot here and say, we'll have to have you back. And so I hope you'll come and share some more with us, because I feel like we've got a lot more that we could get to. But we've come to the end of our time. And so we want to thank you, Dr. Susan Reynolds, for joining us today on Church Life Today. And thanks to everybody else for being with us. We hope you'll join us again next time.